once only sky. Imagine all the people living for today. Imagine there's no countries. It isn't hard to do. Nothing to kill or die.
And good evening, everyone. My name is Barry Seidman, and this is Equal Time for Free Thought. Since economics plays a central role even in the political structures of society, I have put together this series, which included discussions with Michael Perelman, Noam Chomsky, Joel Colvell, Michael Albert, Robin Hanel, and now Takis Fotopoulos. And Fotopoulos, unlike perhaps the others, offers a complete program to facilitate progressive social change. Takis Fotopoulos is a political philosopher, writer, editor, ex-academic, and activist. After studying politics, economics, and law at the University of Athens in Greece, he moved to London for postgraduate study at the London School of Economics. Fotopoulos was a student syndicalist and activist in Athens and then a political activist in London, taking an active part in the 1968 student movement in London, as well as in organizations of the revolutionary Greek left during the struggle against the military junta in Greece. Fotopoulos was a senior lecturer in economics at the University of North London for over 20 years, until he started editing the journal Society and Nature, now online and called the International Journal of Inclusive Democracy. He developed a project of inclusive democracy in 1997, a full exposition of which can be found in his book, Toward an Inclusive Democracy. Welcome, Takis Fotopoulos, to Equal Time for Free Thought. You begin your book, and indeed your analysis of the effects of the growth economy on the society, by calling attention to the multidimensional crisis. Can you give us a brief overview of what this crisis looks like in our everyday lives and how we got to be in such a predicament in the first place?
I think a few people today dispute the fact that society is going through a multidimensional crisis which extends to the political, the economic, the social, the cultural, and of course the ecological level. And in fact, this is a universal crisis in the sense, not only the geographical sense, because the institutions of modernity, I mean the system of market economy and representative democracy is now universal, but also universal in another sense, in the sense of its scope. That is, not only the structures of the present system are now questioned by many people, but also the values themselves, particularly the value of progress with respect to the ecological crisis. And I think that we can trace the causes of this crisis to the concentration of power at all levels that has been created by the institutions of modernity that have been established some 200 years ago, that is the system of market economy and the representative democracy. So we have first a crisis in politics, if you like to start with this, and I think this crisis started since the end of the 18th century when the founding fathers of US Constitution literally invented the representative democracy, because up to then the meaning of democracy prevailing was the classical meaning, I mean the direct exercise of power by people themselves. And then, if we go briefly through the various phases of modernity, we can see how the dynamics instituted by the representative democracy led to more and more concentration of power. We had first concentration of power in the hands of parliamentarians. Then, during the statist phase of democracy, we had concentration of power in governments and the leadership of mass parties. And then today, we have the development of what we may call statecraft. In other words, we have parties changing or replacing each other after elections every 4 or 5 years, parties which are indistinguishable as regards their political programs, which are no longer mass parties. At the same time, we have a rising and huge abstention rate all over the developed capitalist world. respect for politicians is almost nil. Apathy with respect to what passes as politics is growing, although this does not mean apathy in general with respect to politics, as this is shown by Seattle, then Genoa, then today in Argentina, Venezuela, and so on. So far about the crisis in politics. If you like to discuss the causes of it, we can discuss it later. As regards economic crisis, as a result of the globalization process, we have a growing inequality, not only between North and South, but within North and South as well.
For Americans, when you refer to North and South, you mean hemispheres.
Yeah, but what I think we have at the moment is the creation of a bipolar world. In other words, one world which includes the privileged by globalization social groups, and these are found both in the North and in the South. And at the same time, we have the creation of another world which is left out of the supposedly universal benefits of globalization. And the growing gap, which is shown by all kinds of statistics, to give you just one example,
the gap between rich and poor. Yeah,
1% of world population earning 80% of world income, 10% owning 85% of world wealth, and so on. And this, in fact, a growing gap is not just a consequence of the present system, but also a precondition for its reproduction, because actually there are no natural resources for the system to reproduce the standards of living achieved at the standard of consumption, would say better, achieved at the moment in the United States or Western Europe, all over the world. There have been many studies which show this, that this is physically impossible. Then we have a social crisis, because the growth economy, which is an offspring of the market economy, has created a growth society with consumerism, privacy, alienation, disintegration of social ties, and so on, have created a non-family, a non-society, in fact. That is, we move from a society to a non-society where families take place, the place of society. And symptoms of this are, for example, the explosion of crime. In USA, it took 200 years to raise its prison population to 1 million, but the last 10 years it was doubled. And this creates insecurity, not only in lower social groups, but also in upper social groups. We have luxury ghettos which complement the misery ghettos, and so on. Then we have a cultural crisis, which is a direct product of globalization. We have a cultural homogenization, and this has created a backlash in terms of cultural nationalism. And this is again a result of the liberalization and deregulation and commercialization of culture, which is all of these are byproduct, in fact, of globalization. And then, of course, we have the ecological crisis, which has become now front page news with the greenhouse effect and the climate change threatening life itself within the next 50 or at most 100 years, disappearance of species, deforestation, pollution, and so on. And again, this can be shown that it is directly related to the system of the market economy and its offspring, the growth economy. It can be shown, in other words, how, for example, as regards the greenhouse effect, the concentrations of greenhouse gases have increased geometrically since the Industrial Revolution. The cumulative effect is much higher now than in the entire history of human being. So we can see that we have a multidimensional crisis which, in fact, can be traced to the concentration of power that has been created by the institutions of modernity, to my mind.
That's a good overview of the multidimensional crisis. And before we talk about the sort of political or economic system Americans may be most familiar with, the ongoing debate between neoliberal and welfare state markets, you've made clear in your work your thoughts on what you call actual existing socialism. That is, what was or is called socialism in the former USSR, China, today's Cuba. Could not socialism, if we worked to be more democratic than in these countries, for instance, get us out of this crisis?
No, I don't think so, because the problem is with actually existing socialism is that from the beginning it was based on a theory or an ideology of the vanguard of the party, which was supposed to play a hegemonic role or leading role in determining events and so on. The Soviets have been, in fact, replaced by the monopoly of power of the party very early on. Okay, there are objective conditions that could explain this, the encirclement by the West and the war, the Cold War going on later on and so on. But I think these are not enough to explain the distortions of the democratic process that we're supposed to create through the Soviet system. I think that it's the very ideology itself that creates a kind of, if not authoritarian, a kind of non-democratic structure, in the sense that, again, power is concentrated at the hands of elites. In the same way that in the Western system we have power concentrated in the hands of capitalist elites and the elites of parliamentarians and so on, in the Soviet system we had concentration of power at the hands of the Soviet elite, technocrats and so on. So I don't think that this system either could secure political democracy. Perhaps it was better than the Western system in the sense of securing the satisfaction of basic needs of all citizens. In fact, there are Western studies confirming that at the same level of development, the Soviet Union has achieved a higher satisfaction of basic needs than Western system. But at the political level, I don't think that there were any significant steps toward a kind of democracy like the one we're discussing.
Okay. Many liberals and even progressives in the United States might argue that for a while, from just before World War II through the early 1970s, here and in parts of Europe like Scandinavia or Western Europe, a good balance was struck between the capitalist economy and human welfare with Roosevelt's New Deal, Lyndon Johnson's Great Society, and with, like I said, the efforts in, say, Scandinavia. What do you attribute to the rolling back of the social welfare state in America and Europe? And why are you arguing we not return to those pre-Ronald Reagan, pre-Margaret Thatcher conditions?
Yeah, the reason is that on this I disagree profoundly with the reformist left analysis that this is just a matter of the failure of the left or the failure of social democratic parties or the treason of social democratic leaderships and so on. I don't think that these are adequate explanations. I think that we can explain why the social democracy has in effect died since the rise of neoliberal globalization, if we see the economic processes that were going on. Although I do not want to adopt a kind of economistic type of approach, because in my analysis the outcome, the social outcome every time depends on the interaction between objective conditions, that is in this case economic events, and subjective conditions, that is the outcome of the social struggle. But what happened was that as soon as the economy started being internationalized or globalized, that meant that markets had to be liberated, had to be opened, and that meant in turn that statism, in the form that we have known it in the 50s and the 60s, became impossible. And became impossible because open and liberated and unregulated market meant that capital was free to move from country to country to find out where the most profitable conditions of production were available. And obviously, if you have a country like Sweden or Britain, where tax rates in the 50s and the 60s on corporation tax, I mean, and even direct taxes like personal income tax were high for high income groups, then obviously this meant an increase in the cost of production for multinationals and would prefer a country like India or China or whatever, which offer conditions of investment without high cost in terms of tax rates or even in terms of insurance contributions, social insurance contributions for employees and so on. So as soon as the economy became internationalized, statism in the form that we knew it was dead. And every government that tried actually to oppose this trend, there were attempts like President Mitterrand in France or Lafontaine, who was finance secretary of Chancellor Schroeder in Germany and so on. They attempted to reverse this neoliberalism trend, but they had to reverse their policies when they found out that immediately they were trying to get to implement any effective restrictions on capital in terms of high tax rates, etc. Then they were either threatened by a move of capital abroad or by a crisis in the currency or a crisis in the stock exchange and so on, and they had to change policies. So that's why today it's impossible to have the kind of social democracy we had in the 50s and the 60s.
This is Elliot Sober from the Philosophy Department of University of Wisconsin in Madison. You are tuned to WBAI New York, your peace and justice radio. Philosophy as a subject is all about questioning assumptions. That's why I'm a big fan of Equal Time for Free Thought.
Speaking of democracy, this leads me to ask you how you define democracy. As you know, as many Americans don't understand, our founding fathers were hesitant to call what they were creating with the colonies a democracy, calling the United States instead a republic. First, what is democracy if not what we have in America or where you are today in England?
Yeah, the classical, as I said before, the classical meaning of democracy was direct exercise of political power by the people. This was the tradition that started with the Athenian, classical Athenian example, and then it continued later on in the Middle Ages with some cities in Europe, and we see the same trend coming back every time we had any kind of revolutionary or insurrectionary process. That is, that means that it is the people themselves who, through face-to-face assemblies, take all important political decisions. This was the initial conception of political democracy, and this presupposed, of course, a certain degree of decentralization. That's why it was possible in classical Athens, where something like 30,000 people were taking part in assemblies once or twice a month, but it was also possible in the French Revolution, in the sections of 1790s, where neighborhoods were concentrating in neighborhood assemblies, and they were assembling there and they were heading the meetings. And you could imagine a system where these assemblies are federating in regional assemblies and then in confederal assemblies and so on. So it has been done in the past, and this was actually the original idea, because there is no democracy if, in fact, your will is not expressed directly. That is, you can perhaps delegate your will, you can appoint the delegate to express your wishes on particular issues, but nobody can express your own will. That is, you simply give power to somebody else when you elect a representative to take decisions for you within a period of 4 years without asking you on any important issues that he or she takes decisions. That's what representative democracy means. And in fact, there is a very good study by Woods, an American writer, who showed how the representative democracy that was introduced by the founding fathers was not introduced because they thought that the population sizes were so big so that it was impossible to have direct democracy, but on the opposite, it was introduced and explicitly was stated so because they thought that we cannot leave the masses to decide everything and so on, and we need, in other words, to create such a system so that it is the elites, although they may not have used the term, which take decisions actually on important issues. So the idea of direct democracy is one that is coming back again and again, up to the May 68, of course, up to today, every kind of insurrection we have in Latin America, Venezuela, Argentina, and so on, you would see people meeting in general assemblies and taking decisions directly.
Is there a possible role for something called the state, maybe a less hierarchical government in a direct democracy, or is that completely impossible, an oxymoron?
Yeah, in what sense?
For instance, you're not correlating the kind of confederations and assemblies to a hierarchical kind of government we're used to, where you have a top-down hierarchy. So I'm assuming in a direct democracy where you eliminate a top-down hierarchy, you don't really have anything that anyone would recognize as a state anymore.
This is the whole idea, that today we have what we may call statist democracy, in the sense that it presupposes what many people in the literature call separation of polity from society. Today, in other words, society is not polity itself, whereas in a direct democracy, society and polity are integrated. They are one. So in this sense, direct democracy is a stateless democracy. That is, it's not a rule, as some libertarians call direct democracy. It's not a rule because rule presupposes that there is a minority which separates itself from society and takes decisions. But when a rule is spread all over the society, in other words, when everybody takes part in the decision-taking process, sets the laws and agrees with the laws or not suggested by other people taking part in the assembly, then in fact there is no rule anymore. In fact, there is no separation of society from polity. So I can't see how you can have any kind of democracy coexisting with the state, because in this case we don't have anymore an integrated society with polity. We have two different systems.
Okay. All of this adds up to what you have called inclusive democracy. Sound bites are not what our show is all about, but if someone asked you to define inclusive democracy in 75 words or less, what would you say?
Yeah, I would say inclusive democracy is the authority of demos, and by demos I mean the civil body in a particular area. It may be a town or maybe several communities and so on. So it's the authority of demos, of demos over the political decision-taking process, the economic decision-taking process, and generally over any kind of decisions that can be taken collectively. And that's why I defined the constituents, the main elements of inclusive democracy, as being political or direct democracy, which refers to the institutions institutionalizing direct political decision-taking by the assemblies, then economic democracy, which means that it is again assemblies that take all important decisions, citizens' assemblies, and also workplace assemblies, which define the way in which work should be done at a workplace, factory, office, and so on. Then it's democracy in the social realm, which means, in effect, self-management in education, in work, and so on. And finally, ecological democracy, which means the reintegration of society with nature. In other words, to sum it up, inclusive democracy is the reintegration of society with polity, the economy, society, and nature.
So, let's do a thought experiment. In some future society, we've eliminated free market capitalism, market socialism, such as social democracy, and the hierarchical state. What was formerly known as the United States of America is now an inclusive democracy. What would we see? For instance, have we returned to several thousand little communities, as primitivists argue for? Could we really operate without presidents, governors, and mayors?
What we can imagine is that, first of all, we need a radical decentralization. That is, you cannot have a direct democracy or an inclusive democracy for that purpose in a country the size of the United States unless you have radical decentralization. And radical decentralization does not mean physical decentralization. It can be administrative decentralization. Administrative, yeah. And this can be done and has been done in the past. In fact, decentralization is today, I would say, necessary if we want to take any effective measures to deal with the ecological crisis. Apart from the fact that decentralization would create again the social ties which have been destroyed by the present market society and so on. So once you have decentralization and you have, say, divided a country like the United States into units of, say, 50,000 people each unit, then, which let's call it a demos, then each demos of 50,000 people could have its own demotic assembly, which would take all basic political and economic decisions. I'll explain in a moment what I mean by economic decisions. And then given that there are, of course, many problems which could not be solved at the local level, there are regional problems, for example, electricity and so on, or there may be confederal problems which refer to the entire United States or even to the entire world.
Yeah, I was going to question stuff like the space program or how to deal with global warming or health care. Yeah.
So we can have, therefore, confederations of DIMI that would sort out, would deal with the problems that cannot be sorted out at the local level, either at the regional or the confederal level. Then, as regards the economic, in particular, arrangements, what we suggest in the Inclusive Democracy Project is not to leave everything to planning mechanisms, as it is usually the case in various socialist models, but instead to combine a kind of artificial market with the planning mechanism. That's why we make the crucial distinction between basic needs and non-basic needs.
You just said artificial markets, and I've been discussing with friends of mine how market abolitionists argue that the marketization process, and you argue this in your book as well, is the key problem, is the key economic reason we are in the multidimensional crisis to begin with. What exactly do you mean by artificial markets? How is it different than markets?
That, this market would not presuppose a monetary system, and neither a state, of course. And therefore, in effect, what it means is that we have a market that creates a sort of artificial prices so that the allocation of resources takes place. This works through a system, a voucher system, as we proposed, but in fact, with modern technology, it could work also with a special credit card. That is, credit cards could play exactly the same role as vouchers. What we have in mind is that to come back to the distinction I made between basic and non-basic needs, that as regards basic needs, the principle applying on the satisfaction of basic needs, we think, has to be the old communist principle, from each according to his ability, to each according to his her need. And we say so because no freedom of choice can be achieved without satisfaction of basic needs for all citizens.
What do you mean by basic needs?
Basic needs is something that would be defined by demotic assemblies, that is, which are the basic needs and even what is the entitlement of each citizen for basic needs. I would imagine, however, that assemblies would determine that basic needs are not just the survival needs, that is, food, clothing, housing, and so on, but also the needs that today have become basic for modern society, like communication needs, travel needs, apart, of course, from health, education, and so on, the welfare needs.
All the people would have a say in determining what the basic needs are?
Yeah, what they have to determine is, first, not in the basic, not in the demotic assembly. What we suggest is that to get homogeneity in the covering of basic needs in a country, say, like the USA, then it's the Confederal Assembly that would determine which are the basic needs and which are the ways of, the entitlement of each citizen so that these basic needs could be met. Then, however, we introduce the element of freedom of choice, which is a basic drawback of usual planning models that, in fact, do not secure freedom of choice when they say that you have to predict a year in advance what will be your consumption, etc. That's why we have this system of vouchers or credit card, where you can use your basic vouchers to decide which are the satisfiers, that is, the means of satisfying the basic needs. So you don't have a voucher saying that you have to use clothes from the state monopoly, because this creates all the problems that have been created in the Soviet Union. But instead, you can choose from any collective that produces clothes using your basic voucher to buy from them using your voucher. And this way, you secure freedom of choice, and at the same time, you cover the basic needs. As regards the non-basic needs now, there you could apply the principle of meeting the non-basic needs on the basis of effort rather than on the basis of need, as which we discussed before.
And the confederations, there are, just so I understand, there are several of these Confederate-level groups of people across a land the size of the United States, so that there would be more than a very small amount, more than a concentrated amount of people making these kinds of decisions of what basic needs or non-basic needs are and what should be the choices?
The idea is because otherwise, through the confederal assemblies, you may create new kind of hierarchies. So to avoid this, what we propose is that both regional assemblies and confederal assemblies should consist of recallable delegates. That is, it is the demotic assemblies, the base level, which will take the decisions about what is a basic need. And then these decisions will be conveyed through the delegates to regional assemblies, and then through the regional delegates to the confederal assembly. So in effect, it is the majorities that have been created de facto in demotic assemblies that would determine at the confederal level which are the basic needs and how we satisfy them. And in fact, the demotic assemblies have, as I said, the power to recall any delegate which who is not going to implement the decisions at the demotic level.
Hello, this is Noam Chomsky. You're listening to WBAI New York, your Peace and Justice radio station. It's hard to remember a time when it was more important to defend equal time for free thought. I hope you'll all join in doing so.
And welcome back to Equal Time for Free Thought. I'm Barry Seidman, and this is the second half of the full hour special on inclusive democracy with Takis Fotopoulos. If you're interested in researching more on inclusive democracy, you can either pick up his book called Toward an Inclusive Democracy or visit his website at inclusivedemocracy.org. And now, here's the conclusion of our discussion.
A lot of people come to me and say they're appalled and bewildered when I tell them that this is a society without money, without a form of currency. Are vouchers another kind of money or currency that just has no centralized banks?
That's why we suggest a system of vouchers rather than money itself, because money has, in fact, three basic functions. It is a medium of exchange, of course, but it is also a store of wealth and the unit of account. Now, we want to abolish the function of money as a store of wealth, and that's why vouchers are personal vouchers. That is, are issued for each person on the basis of his own basic needs, or if he or she works more than the basic number of hours, then is entitled to non-basic vouchers. And as I said, this could be done also through a credit card system. We want to abolish money exactly in order not to play the role of store of wealth, because if you say that these vouchers are issued in terms of normal money, then some people may save more, other people may be willing or not... for any reason, not using all the vouchers and so on.
Right. So no accumulation is allowed then?
Yeah, this way you have some sort of accumulation building up and accumulation of wealth. And this accumulation of wealth through could easily create in the future pressures for even the restoration of a proper market rather than the artificial market we're talking about. That's why we're talking about personal vouchers.
On the larger scale in producing products and goods and things we need, food, etc., how does, in an inclusive democracy, goods get distributed?
You mean how you could achieve some sort of equal satisfaction between very different regions? Is that
Well, yeah, because obviously not every single community or group of people have the resources and ability at hand to create all the stuff that they need. It has to be, I mean, not only will natural resources or man-made resources be distributed from one area of what's now the United States to another, but also from one part of the world to another. So how does this happen in your system?
There is a high diversity in the distribution of natural resources, especially in a country like the USA. So that's why we propose that the confederal assemblies will take care when they decide the resources available in the Confederation. They will take care of the diversities, and in fact will take explicit action to distribute equally the benefits from the natural resources in various areas, because otherwise, of course, you cannot talk about individual and social autonomy being achieved by all members of the Confederation. Then you're talking about another jungle being created by richer areas becoming over wealthy and poorer areas becoming perhaps even poorer than before. So, yeah, it is within the duties of the Confederal Assembly to redistribute the benefits of natural advantages equally among all members. Actually, this is being done is supposed to be done today within, for example, the European Union. That is, they are supposed to be trying to redistribute the benefits of the inequality of natural resources between various countries in Europe through subsidies and so on. So I suppose even if in a capitalist union like the European Union, at least they are supposed to do this, then it could be done even more in confederal inclusive democracy.
Okay. Co-producer of mine asked me this question about inclusive democracy. He said, what about the innovation capitalist markets seem to produce as far as new products or scientific advances and new technologies are concerned? What would be our incentive to produce other than what some community thinks it needs or wants so that we don't stall progress? And of course, to add a qualifier, by progress, I mean ecologically safe progress.
Yeah, good question. Okay. First of all, we have to understand that the aims of this system that I described do not include growth as such. In other words, we are supposed to move away from a growth economy because this is the only way, anyway, we can create a sustainable society today, I mean ecologically sustainable society. So that's why we argue that the basic aim is to meet the basic needs of all people and the non-basic needs of people who are willing to offer more effort so that they can satisfy better their basic needs or other needs. Now, that means that although growth is out, still there may be a necessity to have some sort of growth. If, for example, we need more investment in order to produce something more economically or perhaps in a way that satisfies better human needs. This is something that could be done through the assembly system because nobody argues that in confederal inclusive democracy there will be no experts who are trying to devise new methods of production and so on. That is, the difference with present capitalist society is that today it is capitalist corporations and so on which decide on the basis of their own motives, the profit motives and so on, which new techniques and new technologies would be adopted or not. Whereas in a confederal inclusive democracy, experts again could suggest new methods of production, and there is no reason, I can see no reason why assemblies would not decide for the introduction of a new invention or a new way of producing and so on, as long, of course, as you said, that this does not create a serious ecological problem.
Right. What about information? How does information spread in an inclusive democracy? Radio, internet, books? How? I'm assuming it's similar, but I'm just curious because it's sort of an intangible.
Yeah, it is supposed that mass media and means of communication in general are controlled, again, by assemblies on the one hand and on the other the people working the mass media enterprises, if you like to call them like this. In other words, on the one hand, the demotic assemblies and the regional assemblies, if we are talking about regional media, will take the general guideline decisions about what sort of policies, say, a TV channel would have, for example, not to produce pornographic programs or whatever. And the mass media people, the people working in mass media, would decide what sort of programs they would present in detail, that is, whether they are going to have scientific programs or entertainment programs or whatever. This would be decided at the level of the mass media, but within the general guidelines given by the assemblies.
The assemblies and the confederations and everything in between, we're talking about this, I suppose, on a general level of people, of the demos. But is there a separate set of assemblies, for instance, within what is now corporations, within large groups of people producing specific things?
There are also workplace assemblies which are based in each workplace, either it is a factory or it is an office, or it may be an education institution and so on. Now, these workplace assemblies take all the decisions for the day-to-day running of the workplace and the decisions about how to divide the task of production and so on the basis of first the instruction given as regards the production of basic goods from the confederal assembly and on the basis of the demand they have for their products, which is revealed by the voucher system. So again, as in mass media, it is the confederal assembly that would give instructions as regards the targets for the covering of basic needs, but as regards the non-basic needs, it's consumers themselves that decide what each individual enterprise would produce, and then it is the workplace assembly that would take all the decisions about the running of the factory, etc.
Just two more questions on this level of sort of philosophical questions. I'm going to play a devil's advocate here because I don't necessarily believe what I'm about to read, but I have a question that some people do ask me. What about human nature? Some people here in the United States, some of my friends, in fact, would ask, how would such a cooperative, egalitarian society function with such greedy, selfish, warlike creatures that human beings are running the show?
Yeah, I think this is, in fact, an ideology that is the attempt to explain human nature on the basis of what is human nature or what human nature has developed today, is not irrelevant to the institutional framework that developed in the last 200 years. In other words, it's the value systems that prevailed since the emergence of the system of the market economy 200 years ago, the individualistic values, the competitive values, and so on, which are part of the liberal ideology. It is this value system, or rather within this framework of this value system, that we can explain such ideas that human nature is individualistic and so on. There is no scientific evidence to show this, and in fact I don't think that we are born either to be individualistic, competitive and so on, or as some liberal philosophers argue, or alternatively I don't think that we are born to be to believe in solidarity, to behave in mutual aid fashion and so on. I think that all these are determined later on through the socialization process. That is, from day one that we are born, we are socialized to adopt certain values by family, by school, and so on, by mass media, etc. So all these ideas about human nature being this or that, I think they simply reflect the institutional framework of society.
This is Judith Hand, author of Women, Power, and the Biology of Peace, and creator of AFutureWithoutWar.org, the website. You're listening to WBAI New York, your Peace and Justice Radio, the place where you can find much-needed equal time for free thought.
America and much of the world outside of Europe is still pretty religious, from New Age spirituality to Christian and Islamic fundamentalism. Such powerful cultural coping mechanisms and supernaturalistic explanations for reality skew what we know and what we do. How will inclusive democracy work under these or through these circumstances?
Yeah, a basic condition or precondition, I would say, for democracy, and I mean genuine democracy, like inclusive democracy, is that people take decisions and make their own laws, and society itself makes its own laws and recognizes itself as the source of these laws. That means that irrationalisms of various kinds, like the ones you mentioned, cannot be the basis for a genuine democratic society. Of course, this does not exclude the possibility that some individual citizens may be religious, but no democratic society could survive if they try to bring in these values, the religious values, into the decision-taking process, because then we are not going to have a democracy anymore. It's not our own laws that we vote for, but it's the laws that are written in the Quran or in the Bible or whatever. So all these sorts of irrationalism are by definition excluded by an inclusive democracy, in the sense that no democracy could be based on religion or any other kind of irrationalism. Although, as I said, at the individual level, this does not exclude the possibility that some people may still believe this, but they believe in God or whatever. But once they take part in the assemblies, they have to accept the basic democratic principle that it is we here that we take our own decisions, we vote for our own laws, that we define our truth if we like, and we do not take any externally given truth.
Well, you know, obviously in a representative democracy like here in the United States, where there is some, or at least supposed to be, constitutional laws separating church and state, if you no longer have organized churches necessarily being able to influence power, because that would be authoritarian, or the state influencing power, and you have just the demos, I'm just wondering how feasible it would be to not assume that large groups of people who consider themselves religious, say Islamic or Christian fundamentalists, and there are plenty of them go around, wouldn't as a group try to influence the demos based on this external truths? And how would an inclusive democracy prevent that?
Yeah, but here we do a big jump.
Yeah, yeah, it is.
If you assume that we try to establish tomorrow an inclusive democracy in the United States or in Iran, obviously this is impossible. That is, there is a transitional process that we have to go through. And during this transitional process, you could expect that people would create a different kind of consciousness for a different kind of society. So you could expect that, and actually this is a basic element of the transitional strategy we suggest, we didn't discuss it, but this is a basic element that we want to achieve this kind of society by trying to first educate people, and second and more important, by creating institutions within the present society which prefigure the inclusive democracy. It is, in other words, the interaction of education and practice that would lead to this new kind of society. You could expect, and this is what we require actually, that this democratic consciousness should have become hegemonic before society changes into an inclusive democracy. This was, I would say, the basic flow of the socialist strategy, the Leninist strategy, and so on. That is, they try to conquer power and then from above to create a new consciousness. I think that unless the democratic consciousness has become hegemonic before we reach the new kind of society, then this is going to fail as it failed in the Soviet Union and so on. We expect at least the majority, by the time we have an inclusive democracy, would not be fundamentalist or religious like you describe it.
We could also make the argument, and others on this show have, that a good reason there is so much, or a reawakening of fundamentalist religiosity, in obviously in the Middle East and in the United States, is because of the multidimensional crisis leading people towards more radical forms of religion.
That's true, yeah. That is, you can explain it, why, for example, the Arab population have become fundamentalist today. This was not always so. 20, 30 years ago, you had Arab nationalism, you had Arab socialism, but not fundamentalism. So it is part of the multidimensional crisis that you had this shift to religious fundamentalism. So, of course, when we are talking about how we move to an inclusive democracy, we're talking in terms of getting out of this multidimensional crisis. We see inclusive democracy not just as a utopia, but as a way of getting out of this multidimensional crisis.
Well, that was my last question. How do we get from here to there? What are some steps that we could, you know, the demos, could take to get from here to there? You mentioned education and turning back the multidimensional crisis, but perhaps you could lay out for us some examples by reference of social examples, of political, economic examples. What's the strategy to get from here to there?
I think that a strategy leading to an inclusive democracy should basically aim three basic, three important or fundamental aims. First, to create a rupturing of the socialization process so that a new social paradigm for a genuine inclusive democracy becomes hegemonic, as I mentioned before. Second, that we have the gradual involvement of increasing numbers of people in a new kind of politics, where in the new kind of organization they would implement the principles and the values of an inclusive democracy. And third, that we have a parallel shifting of economic resources from the market economy through the creation of those new institutions I mentioned, which in fact are new popular bases of political and economic power.
Yeah, what are some examples of those political and economic societies, so to speak?
First of all, such experiments are already at work, both in Europe and I think in the United States as well. That is, there are various experiments to create new institutions at the economic level. In Britain, there are the LET schemes, which try to abolish money and create direct exchange to help unemployed people. There are, of course, co-ops, there are workers' councils in various places, there are eco-villages in Australia and so on. Now, the problem with all these, because these are in fact prefigurings of a future society. The problem with all these experiments, however, is that they are not integral parts of a new anti-systemic movement, of a new movement to replace the present system of market economy and representative democracy. They are just the individual examples, people, groups of people in various parts of the world try through example to create the consciousness in order to move to a different society, which I think is doomed to failure. There has to be, in other words, a political project. There has to be an analysis of the present situation, the envisioning of the kind of society we want to build, and the strategy to move from here to there. Now, all these groups, in fact, do not have all these, do not satisfy all these conditions, and that's why usually they are marginalized, or they even be used by the system itself so that they could replace the lack of welfare services now through these kind of services from below. So this is one way. Another way that we suggest is contesting local elections, which is not only an educational exercise, but also could give us the chance to begin changing society from below here and now, rather than waiting to change society from above after the conquest of state power and so on.
What would go into contesting a local election? What would someone be doing?
Yeah, actually, some libertarians do criticize us for taking part in local elections in the sense that we may this way recognize state institutions and so on. In fact, there are many references, even classical anarchists like Bakunin, who think that local elections are a completely different kind of election from state elections. That is, there is a direct link, there are direct ties between citizens and councils. And the question is how, when you say contesting the elections, you gain power in a particular area, in a particular local area, how you can create institutions of direct democracy, I mean neighborhood assemblies and so on, and economic institutions like cooperatives, etc., demotic enterprises and so on, how you create such institutions which in fact replace the present representative institutions, or you make them just formalities. That is, the essence of political and economic power could be moved to people themselves directly once you gain power in some particular areas. But even if you don't gain power, again, there is the educational advantage that you can have contact and appeal to many more people than by trying to achieve the same through individual example in your neighborhood and so on.
One final question. The multidimensional crisis that we're trying to alleviate through inclusive democracy and bring us to a truly liberatory society, concerning a sense of urgency, do you think politically and economically, the way globalization is taking the world right now, that there is a timeline that we have to which if we go too much further past that, we will get to a point of no return? Do you think, you know, this is...
Yeah, latest studies show that, in fact, the crisis is accelerating, the ecological crisis is accelerating, and scientists are surprised that we move faster than they thought.
Not just ecologically, but politically and economically and...
Yeah, as regards the other aspects of the crisis, the economic crisis, again, is there in the sense of the bipolar world you mentioned. That is, at the moment, in China, say, people work like slaves because they believe they could all have their own car and their own villa, if not a swimming pool and so on. But once they see in the near future that this is impossible, and at the same time the gap between the privileged social groups and the rest is growing, as it is at the moment, then the present social unrest will become more and more serious. Now, the same happens also to some extent in the developed world. That is, you've heard about the present crisis in the USA in terms of the credit crisis created by the mortgage problem, and the same problem had arisen in Britain as well. So these are just symptoms of the fact that this is a system that it is fundamentally unstable. Now, I do not want to say that the system would fall by itself because of this crisis. However, whatever the degree of seriousness of this crisis is at the moment and would become in the future, then nothing would happen leading to an inclusive democracy. Don't say this. You may perfectly have the development of an eco-fascist society or any kind of authoritarian society. At the moment, we are moving towards authoritarian society.
Authoritarian fascist society, yes.
Yeah, through the war against so-called terrorism and so on, we are moving to towards the abolition of basic human liberties and so on. So, in effect, all these greater authoritarianization of these societies simply means that these crises, the various crises I mentioned, become more and more serious. Now, what will happen at the end would depend, of course, on how people would react to these developments. If they passively accept everything, as at the moment many people seem to do, then of course nothing would happen. But if they start reacting, then you may see all sorts of new movements like the inclusive democracy movement developing.
Well, I certainly hope so. And maybe Europe will be the place to start this off, because the United States seem to be so ingrained in their rugged, individualistic, strongly competitive mindset that it's hard to imagine going from here to there right now in this country. Thank you, Takis Fotopoulos, for joining us in Equal Time for Free Thought today.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.